Talk given Sunday, 5th January, 1975. We all know the word orgy. It comes from the Greek orgia, which means ceremonial rites to celebrate the birth of a deity. It is accompanied with frenzied or ecstatic singing and dancing. And our word orgy is derived from orgia. There is that other word, orgasm, which is derived from orgasmos, meaning a kneading, K-N-E-A-D-I-N-G, or a softening, making pliant. It is, orgasmos is sometimes confused, in fact it is more often confused with organ, which means excitement, especially venereal excitement. And we have the two words, orgiastic, in connection with orgy, and orgasmic in connection with orgasm. Now this celebration of rites in connection with a deity characterizes all the world's major religions, where the four religions, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islam are concerned, there are millions of followers of each of these religions. And they all have their special days for celebration. Perhaps the best known in the world is, of course, Christmas. Best known by virtue of the fact that Christendom today comprises something like 1,000 million and possibly more people on the face of the globe. That means over a quarter of the world's population. In the course of these 2,000 years since the birth of Christ, what has this celebration meant in practical terms? It is associated primarily with jollification. An occasion for pleasure, involving so much expenditure of wealth, so much squandering of energy. It is true that it is also associated with family union, meeting together, the exchange of greetings and good feeling and all the rest of it. But this other aspect, on the whole, this pursuit of pleasure is the predominant characteristic of the celebration of Christmas. A great many people in this century seem to have lost any feeling for or connection with the religious aspect of this holy day. And it has degenerated into sheer sense indulgence. It is strange that the founders of the great religions, whose perhaps supreme concern was man's happiness, and who showed the way to real happiness and fulfillment, should be celebrated in course of time, and not so very long after their deaths, by in just those ways which the teachers pointed out were productive of illness, illness of body, illness of mind, degeneration of character, and so on. What is the root source of such degeneration? Is not the root source of such degeneration a state of inward ignorance, an unawakened, unaware state, a state in which we have no true human sensitivity, only the animal sensitivity is uppermost? And we give way to it. Now this is a matter which requires very serious consideration by those of us who are truly concerned with the religious life, with the fruition of our human nature. Because this pursuit of pleasure and this production of all the means for mere pleasure is one of the most powerful causes of man's degeneration and his troubles. It's easy enough to see greed and hate, ambition, delusion, selfishness. It's easy enough to see all those as causes of our trouble. But all those are related at root with this passion for pleasure, for sensational excitement and delight. How does pleasure come to us? It comes through the avenues of the senses and through sense functioning. Does that mean then that the senses are evil? Not at all. Because it is through these very senses as avenues that right pleasure comes to us. Real happiness comes to us through these very senses. This is a fact we must never forget in our day and age. Unfortunately, through the centuries, the conventional presentation of religious teaching and religious discipline has decried the senses. The senses are regarded as a snare, as the instruments of the devil for our damnation. That is not the truth about the senses at all. Because of this state of ignorance in which we are, we have allowed this to happen. And we have become enslaved by it. But the senses are the avenues for right pleasure, for supreme happiness. If you look at one of the discourses of the Buddha, which comes towards the end of the first volume of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses, you will find him talking to Ananda, his beloved disciple, and explaining the grades of happiness. It's a very interesting discourse altogether. You know how, in the Buddha's teaching, par excellence, constant emphasis is laid upon the control of the senses. He tells you all the time to beware of delight through the senses. And then, in this discourse, where he grades happiness, he starts off by telling Ananda that there is the pleasure which you get through sights, through sounds, through touches, through smells and tastes and so on. And he says, this is happiness in the world. And then he proceeds from that to other states which he declares are sources of an even greater and more excellent happiness. And those other states are the entry successively into the deeper and deeper states of consciousness in meditation, culminating in the ninth, which is called the cessation. And he calls that the supreme happiness. But it is peculiarly interesting that he does include what we would commonly call worldly happiness as the first stage of happiness. And if you look at the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you will find again suddenly Yajnavalkya, the great teacher, telling King Janaka, giving him a list of the grades of happiness. And he mentions worldly happiness as the very first one. If a man is healthy, if he is happy with his wife and children, if he is free of anxiety, where daily livelihood and so on is concerned, he is a happy man. 100 times that happiness is the happiness of a man who enters the next deep state of consciousness. And again, it is these different states of consciousness which are tabulated, and each time he multiplies the happiness of the previous stage 100 times, till he reaches the grand figure of 1,000,000 times 1,000,000 happiness as compared with worldly happiness, when that person has realized ultimate reality, become one with Brahman, realized transcendence. But the first one is the one in the world. Now, does that mean, I'm just giving 2 instances, you'll find lots of instances through the scriptures of this sort of thing. Does this mean that by worldly happiness they meant what the man in the world, the ordinary man in the world today, means by pleasure or happiness in the world? It's extremely doubtful. Because consider carefully, the wild pursuit of pleasure destroys body and soul. That is an undeniable fact of life. Yet the great teachers talked of worldly happiness as the first grade of happiness. Look at the matter this way, that the wild pursuit of happiness is, where man is concerned, not animalish. I wouldn't insult the animal world that way. It is brutish, is it not? Man degraded doesn't descend to an animal level. He converts himself into a brute, with all the connotations attached to that word brute and to the word brutish. But if a man so lives that he is free of this brutishness, does he cease to enjoy pleasure through the avenues of the senses? Have not you and I seen the beauty and the marvel of a cloud in the sky? Its edge glittering with gold, surrounded by the blue of the sky? Have you not heard the song of a bird, the happy laughter and play of children, the sound of the sea, the singing of the leaves as the wind blows through? Have we not seen the beauty of human faces, of their walk, their speech, their affection? Have we not touched and felt things which gave us a sense of upliftment? Does not the whole cosmos flow in towards us in a tide of happiness. In actual fact, and if we receive it rightly, if we are no longer in the ignorant state, but the awakened, the enlightened state, what is there to prevent that happiness from absolutely filling us day and night? This is not to suggest that the world around us as it is, especially in the big cities of the world, is pouring in a flood of the lovely things, the beautiful things, the happiness-producing things. It's the very reverse. But if we are not in big cities, we are in the midst of the lovely things. We are listening to wonderful music, or seeing beautiful pictures, or statues, or buildings, or whatever it is. Even if we are in the midst of that, if our attention is caught up with our own personal problems, then we fail to respond to that beauty, don't we? In a lifetime in a big city, how often there are wonderful sunsets. I've seen them myself over and over again. Wonderful sunsets, wonderful dawns. But when you look at the people, they are scurrying past, oblivious to the loveliness around them. That's not the fault of nature or the cosmos. It's our unawakened state, is it not? You see, it is very important. It is intensely important to be happy, to experience right pleasure. The Buddha says, for instance, that when there is that happiness, the mind is rapturous and able to enter the deep states of consciousness. It is as significant as that, to be happy. But how shall we be happy that way? Let us look at what causes the wrong type of pleasure to come into our life. Is it not because we pursue our concept of happiness, which is a misconcept altogether, and we grasp at the means, the tools for obtaining sensational excitement? If we grasp at, if we pursue happiness, it means that we are self-centered all the time. And not only are we self-centered, but we have our own idea of what pleasure, happiness means. Even a superficial glance at the ideas which people have of what happiness means will show us that they have no idea at all, no true idea of what real happiness is. Therefore, if we cease to pursue pleasure, but remain balanced, calm, poised, awake, then we are intensely sensitive to everything around us. And we are able to absorb all that comes to us through the avenues of our senses. This is a very important aspect of the experiencing of happiness. The psyche has to absorb the impressions that come in. And the impressions have to be allowed to come in. We haven't to seek them. It is impossible to prevent these impressions to come in because we are alive and awake. And the whole universe, being alive and active all the time, will send these impressions to us. You can't escape them. You can't escape happiness if you are sensible, in the real meaning of the term. That means being very sensitive, awake. Let it come in. Then you will discover the meaning of right pleasure and of right happiness. But remember the important point involved here. There must be no pursuit of pleasure. Therefore, no self-centeredness in it. No mistaken activity to produce pleasure according to our concepts. Then the reality comes to you. You don't have to seek it. Now you might wonder why I have spent such a long time over this matter, which seems, well, it's perfectly obvious that that is so. How obvious? Do we really know this? We imagine we do. All of us, we suffer from pride, from self-conceit, from vanity, from egoism, and we believe that, oh yes, of course I know this, etc., etc. Do I? If I really knew it, would my life be today what it is from day to day? The test is action. What do I actually do? And that means not merely physically with the body. What do I do with my feelings, my desires, my thoughts? So I imagine that I know all this, but I don't really. If I really knew this, I'd be continuously happy, continuously poised and quiet. Saying only what was essential to say, doing only what was essential to do. But is that the case with the world? Or even with us? Look at the extraordinary amount of fussiness, of busyness, busybodiness, and so on, with which we plague ourselves and our environment. And then when we turn to religion and think in terms of living the religious life, do we ever ask ourselves, what element of the pursuit of happiness impels us to be religious? This is a terribly important question. Even if I had taken 2 hours to lead up to it, those 2 hours would not be too long. They would be worthwhile. This is a terribly important question. It is so easy to be deceived. Self-deceived, I mean. The context of religion is transcendence. In this context, you and I, as individual beings, come to fruition, to human fulfillment. But that which defeats human fulfillment everywhere, every time, is self-centeredness, making the self a block in the path of the light of transcendence. And it is the pursuit of pleasurable sensation, whether it be in terms of just a sensational experience, or the pursuit of our ambitions, or our objectives, or aims, etc. They are all self-oriented ultimately. The man who shouts out loudest that he is only concerned with serving God is the man who fills the devil's heart with joy. God doesn't need any serving. What qualifications have I to serve God? What extraordinary conceit. You see, it is myself I'm serving, identifying myself with the family of God, the God of my conceptions at that. You see how easy it is to fall down by the wayside. All along. But now, let us take it that we have begun to understand this matter. The necessity to be fully awake to our own selfness, which obstructs true happiness, true fulfillment, which is the real obstruction to the religious life. Starting from there, let us see in which way oneself and the environment is in relationship. If we look at the world and understand it, or begin to understand how it functions, we will see that All the energies in the cosmos interact with each other. The universe interflows within itself. And every single energy acts upon, interacts with every other energy which is at play. It influences it. And since every energy influences everything else, there is an interfluence in that sense, as well as an interflowing in the sense of an interpenetrating of all the energies of the cosmos. Now this goes on continuously, and it appears as if it weaves two webs where each one of us is concerned. There is the web of consciousness woven within us. The manner in which we are aware of existence. This is a difficult thing to understand. It is indefinable. We know what a particular thought is, a particular feeling, what a particular mood is, and so forth. But does any one of us know what consciousness is? If so, tell me. Consciousness is an indefinable thing, but we use the word quite easily. The actual fact of our experience is simply this, that if I see something or hear something, and if I am paying attention to what I am seeing or hearing, then I am conscious of that which I see and that which I hear. The verb to be conscious has real meaning. You and I are conscious of so and so. But consciousness, it's not like my liver or heart or brain or anything I can isolate. It is a mystery, consciousness itself. So it is about the ultimate that I can get at with respect to myself, consciousness. Something which is transcendent, really. And this web of consciousness is what I like to call the light of the soul, which is entrusted to me for my keeping. I have to tend this light of the soul. This is what I call destiny. The destiny is within me, this mysterious power. Why is this so important? Because it is fundamental to my whole being and my whole life process. My states of mind, the thoughts, the feelings, the ideas, my bodily condition, etc., and my environment, my circumstance, is fundamentally governed by this mystery, this destiny inside me, this web of consciousness, the manner in which I am aware. And the whole of the religious life, by means of which one wakes up to reality, wakes up to what actually is present here and now. That constitutes the discipline of the religious life, which enables this destiny, this light of the soul to shine out, and become apparent to me here in the world. That is why it is so important. It is not my passing thoughts, my passing feelings, my passing states. It's not my actions. It certainly is not my planning or ambition or anything, which is the important thing. All that obstructs this light. Therefore, there is no true human fulfillment. Well, this is one web, this, which is destiny. What is the other web? I'm splitting the two, I'm setting it up as two purely for convenience of consideration. Otherwise, we can't talk at all about it. The whole thing is just one reality, true enough, but if we are entirely within the one, then that's the end of it. We had to observe perfect silence. Now, the other is the web which I call fate. It is something external to me as a psychophysical being, as a particular psychophysical being. It's not only the environment, in the ordinary sense of the word environment. These energies of the cosmos are not merely energies as known and discovered by science so far. And science has made marvelous discoveries in the last 15 years about all this. But they all belong to the particular and to the manifested. There is much more still to be discovered. And it is that which is the unknown to us, which is at play. And this web is fate, which is the totality outside me, the separate, the particular individual. And fate in relation to me and destiny within me contains all other destinies. Because my environment includes all other individual beings. Doesn't it? And for each one of them, there is destiny within that person, for whom I constitute part of his fate. You see how we are interrelated in the most extraordinary way, most intimately interrelated. Understand this, and it is perfectly easy to answer the question, am I my brother's keeper? Of course, absolutely, there is no escape from it. Life is one interrelated whole, insofar as you or I as an individual tries to sunder that unity, you and I are sinners. But if we understand that unity, then we understand that what we commonly call the external and try to push outside us, push away from us, try to bend it to our will, is not external to us, but is intimately interrelated with us. Destiny and fate are intimately interrelated. But the difference comes in function. Fate constantly throws the challenge to us. Constantly. And all too often the challenge is so terrific, and it is so subtle, that the mass of human beings go by unheeding, unaware, and they merely flounder through life and end with mere death, not death, which is the perfecter and the consummator, the portal to liberation. When fate throws the challenge, how do we react? We do one of two things. Either we run away because we are afraid, we are hurt, we are fed up, we are uninterested and whatnot. Either we run away, therefore, or try to run away, or we fight against fate. And both are the ways of the ignorant. If I fight against that which is the totality, what happens? I get a bit scratched here and there, a little bit hurt, don't I? And remember, fate always wins, to use a worldly phrase. Fate is prior to me, and fate survives me. This extraordinary web of individual existence, which is woven by the totality, has to wake up to that. And then what happens? When one does wake up to it and really see that there is an interplay, this interflow, this interfluence, then I begin to see that insofar as I succeed in making myself absent from the totality, that is to say, insofar as I cease to obtrude self upon the total reality, fruition can come into being. Not success or fulfillment according to my ideas, but in tune with the way life moves all of us. Now here, there is something very difficult and very important to understand. Transcendence manifests its transcendence by allowing a destiny to unfold. And it unfolds in perfection in the Holy One, the purified, the completely purified Holy One, the true human, which means the happy creator. We have gone into this again and again, the meaning of the word human, the happy creator, comes to complete fruition in the Holy One, in the religious sense, far more than through the genius in science or art or anything else. Transcendence, therefore, manifests its transcendence that way. It also demonstrates its transcendence by withholding fruition in this one and that one and that one. Don't we ourselves know from experience of people who have remarkable gifts, wonderful skills and so forth, and somehow never come to fruition? Fate always knocks them down, as we say. Supposing I am I belong to that category. Then it would be ignorance on my part, folly, to rail against fate or transcendence or God or the circumstance or put the blame on this, that and the other. Quite useless. I must see that this is the way transcendence manifests itself. It's a hard thing to swallow. Extremely difficult. What have I done to deserve this? Why does this sort of pattern of pain and frustration keep repeating itself in my life? Here am I doing everything possible to make life nice for everybody around me and so forth, and this is what happens to me. I get kicked and thwarted. Don't seek consolation under those circumstances. It's a great mistake to seek consolation or look for comfort outside or use the intellect to make excuses for oneself or spin out foolish philosophies to explain away sorrow, deprivation, difficulty, trial, misery, and all the rest of it. Don't do that. Those are all the wrong ways. You remember, time and again I have said, live by letting live. Not live and let live, which is the common phrase, but live by letting live. Understand. Be very observant. Take it into yourself. Don't refuse it. Don't deny it. Take it into yourself and see the transformation that takes place in your own inner being. The extinguishing of what appears to be the extinguishing of the light is the other face of enlightenment. In the sense of lighting up the light. So, let be what is. Let it work itself out. And if I let it work itself out through me, in ways which the world would call frustration, unfulfillment, and so forth, then I have done the right thing. And that is the fulfillment which is my particular destiny. It's a very peculiar thing, isn't it? How will you know light without darkness? How will you know happiness without sorrow? But there comes the point when there is a transcending of the duals, a complete transcending of the duals, and the transcending is not describable. It is neither pleasure nor pain. What is it, you'll ask? There is no dictionary which has the words for it. There is neither what we call fulfillment or unfulfillment in it. But it is a reality for you if you realize that state of awareness, that mode of awareness, in which the separation between the self and the not-self has totally vanished. It is pure awareness, pure consciousness, not I and the world. You are unself-aware of self and the so-called not-self. This is the intelligent state. And you will find that this is the blissful state. Of course, any word I use, remember, is a word which belongs to the context of duality. But you have to try and sort of feel it out into the transcendent through the word which belongs to duality. It is a blissful state. It is a state in which transcendence is allowed to be utterly free in you and through you. It's extremely difficult, but it seems to me that is how the energies which produce this cosmos, which produce you and me and all that happens, this is how they seem to be flowing. Therefore, fate, which throws the challenge, has to be understood, fully understood. Understand fate, and you will understand yourself inside, that web which is destiny for you, and your destiny will come to flower, and the separation between destiny and fate will disappear. In that disappearance, to use the Christian phrase, it is the will of God which has triumphed, come to fruition. Not my will, but thine, O Lord. Then the light of the soul, this web of destiny, the light of the soul, of which you are the keeper, has really flamed up. And your whole being is burning with that light. And it is a light which doesn't consume you as it burns you. It burns, and in the burning it transforms every element of ill within the psychophysical being. So that in certain rare cases there is an actual transfiguration of the body itself. It is this light which is born on Christmas Day. This light of the soul, that web of consciousness which is your particular destiny whilst you are alive. Don't ask me what happens when you're dead. When you're dead, you're dead. That's the answer. If you cannot be satisfied with that, you will never be able to interplay with fate. And it will always defeat you and keep you in fear and in a state of ignorance. Because, you see, one asks that question because one clings to self-persistence. This opaque block which shuts out the light of transcendence wants to continue shutting out the light of transcendence. So, this is the light which is born on Christmas Day. Look at it that way, if you wish to. And if you can enter into it and really work itself out in everyday life, then that particular pattern which is your destiny will uniquely fulfill itself in the course of your life. And that is happiness.